Chapter 15.
Greens Gap, North Carolina, United States of America, Sol 3, 03700 hours EDT, Tuesday, September 29, 2009 AD. Pruitt looked at the tree-covered mountains, filling the main view screen and laughed. Bun Bun's a rabbit, not a monkey! The repairs on the Shiva had been expedited with remarkable speed, since the Shiva Brigade was already in place. By the time the gun got to them, Kilzer and Indy, between them, had worked up a full survey of the damage. After the welders and electricians were done, and some new anti-personnel defenses were installed, it was time to roll. This time with an escort of Abrams and Bradleys spread out like chihuahuas herding an elephant. They had headed up Brushy Fork Creek, the Bradleys, Abrams, and six-wheel drive trucks struggling with the torn path left by the Shiva. Where the Shiva passed, the rougher parts were laid flat, but the weight of the gun turned granite to dust a meter thick. It was, however, the Shiva path or nothing. The narrow dirt road would have been impassable to the tanks even without the damage the giant gun system was doing to it. They had eventually made their way to their current stopping place, the shoulder of a ridge at the head of Bushy Fork, about 3,000 meters across a couple of narrow valleys from Green's Gap. The smaller vehicles had arrayed themselves on the ridges, with a few of the tanks down in the gullies of the creek. There was room for only the Shiva on the hilltop. The tank crews were up in their hatches looking at the route and shaking their heads in the cold. The sun was long gone, taking with it any warmth. The nearly vertical mountains glittered, frosty, under the moon. "Okay, I for one vote that we turn around," LeBlanc's voice crackled over the radio. "Oh, ye of little faith," Kilzer said. He had a multicolored three-dimensional view of the terrain up on his display and now tapped a control to bring sections of it up on Pruitt's targeting system. "Okay, Pruitt, load up a penetrator." Pruitt looked at the screen and shuddered. "You're joking, right?" "Nope," Kilzer said, tapping his keyboard again and bringing up a set of 15 target points on the mountainside. "Okay, it's going to be an expensive road, but we'll have a road, and I won't have to go skiing with you." Pruitt looked over at the colonel, who had a pensive expression on his face. "Colonel, is this going to work, Kilzer?" the officer temporized. "The rounds aren't that big." Kilzer's laugh was deep and infectious. "Oh, Lord, that's a good one, sir," he chuckled. "You've obviously been in Shiva combat too long, sir. They're 10 kiloton rounds. That's the equivalent of 10,000 tons of TNT, sir. 20,000 pounds of explosives." After a moment, Mitchell grinned and chuckled in return. "You're right. My version of what's a small explosion has gotten sort of skewed. Go on." "Each of them is going to vaporize a big chunk of North Carolina rock, sir," the tech replied, pointing out, "and the rock around it is going to settle in rubble. 15 shots, by my calculations, will reduce the ridgeline by only 200 feet or so. But that 200 feet is going to take out the steepest portions and lay down a ramp, a steep ramp, admittedly, on both sides." "Pruitt?" Mitchell said. "I don't know, sir," the gunner admitted. "I mean, one side of me says, hey, it's Bun Bun, no problemo. And then the rational side of me says, it's a friggin' mountain." He rubbed under his helmet for a moment, then grinned. "What the hell, sir? 15 doesn't do it. Hey, how many do we have in reserve?" "There's more coming from the Asheville reserves," Mitchell said. "We'll have 2 full loads of penetrator and 6 area denial after we shoot 15. "Colonel, this is your add-ons. What's the situation?" Major Chan could not hear the conversation and thus was getting curious. "Oh, we're just discussing some engineering details," Mitchell replied over the group net. "Okay, Pruitt, do it." He keyed his mic again and sighed. "Okay, everybody, stand by for big noise." Major LeBlanc had never seen a Shiva fire, and she had to admit that even for someone who crewed Abrams tanks, it was impressive. The 16-inch smooth-bore belch fire with a blast of sound that was like a bellow of a giant. The round itself was essentially an enlarged version of the Abrams main anti-tank round, a depleted uranium dart. The main difference being that the Shiva round had a dollop of antimatter at its core. But like the Abrams silver bullet rounds and the teardrops of the ACS grav guns, the depleted uranium protector and its tungsten stabilization fins left a streak of silver light behind. The light went directly into the shoulder of the right-hand mountain and vanished. There was a flash of light out of the hole, quickly extinguished, and a muted rumble through the ground. "I hope the next one is a little more impressive," one of the tank crews said. The shot might as well have been a pebble dropped in the ocean for all the mountains seemed to care. Pruitt methodically fired all eight of his onboard rounds. Each of them disappeared virtually without a trace. "We're not making any impression, I can see, Kelzer," Mitchell said. "We will, sir," the tech replied, but he looked a tad nervous. Pruitt waited while the reload process went on. Each of the reload truck's specially fitted HMETT vehicles had to pull up to the back of the Shiva and load one round at a time. Then the rounds were transported up to the turret armory. It took quite some time, and by the end of the exercise, the tank crews had gotten out and were walking around, talking, joking, and smoking. Some of them were lighting fires to heat up their rations. "Colonel, you might want the crews in their vehicles," Kilzer noted as Pruitt loaded the next round. Mitchell passed the order on to LeBlanc, who slowly collected her crews. Finally, everyone was loaded back up, and Mitchell gave Pruitt permission to fire. The first set of eight rounds had been a flattened U, following the line of the gap and about 200 feet below the actual ridge line. The ninth and tenth rounds were at the center of the U and had the same effect as the others. Precisely none. "Are we going to see any results soon, Kilzer?" Mitchell asked impatiently. "I thought that last one would have shifted something," Kilzer said with a frown. "Let me check my notes." "What the hell," Pruitt said, lining up the next shot. "I've got rounds to spare." He aimed at the next target point on the shoulder of the first hill about 60 feet above the first shot and fired. Each of the previous rounds had, in fact, had a very solid impression. The antimatter explosion had vaporized a sizable chunk of rock, a sphere ranging from 50 to 100 meters in diameter. But the refractory material above the explosions had managed to survive, and each of the explosions was widely enough spaced that there were ersatz pillars between the newly wrought, extremely hot, slightly glowing caves in the pass's heart. The 11th round, however, penetrated rock that had already been fractured by previous rounds, and the impact of the 10-kiloton blast propagated along the lightly supported bridge of rock across the top of the pass, with, literally, earth-shattering results. "Holy shit," LeBlanc muttered, looking up as the entire pass began to move. "Down! Back us up!" She watched helplessly as a section of mountain larger than the Shiva slowly turned to rubble and began sliding towards three of her tanks. She noted in passing that all of the personnel had dropped into the belly of the vehicles and that they were just getting into motion when her own tank suddenly revved and reversed, slamming her into the combing. She bounced back to the slag where the hatch used to be, banging her back and tearing a hole in the back of her uniform, then howled like a banshee as first one and then two of the tanks disappeared in an avalanche. Kilzer said. "Now we're getting somewhere." "It's okay, Major," the colonel said as soothingly as he could manage. It had taken a while to get the battalion and their commander calmed down enough to have any sort of conversation. Fortunately, most of the tanks weren't loaded with anything that could really harm a Shiva. Otherwise, it might have come to blows. Their gun tubes are still exposed. We can hook up to them on our way up the slope and then pull them out. "You're going to make more shots?" LeBlanc snapped. "They're going to get buried." "Oh, probably not," Kilzer said. "Most of the rest of the rubble should go onto the other side. That shot was just designed to lay down a ramp." "Lay down a ramp?" the major shouted. "You just buried two of my crews." "It's not like they're dead," the tech rep replied. "I mean, they were in their vehicles when the avalanche hit, right?" "I'm going to come over there." "No, you're not," Mitchell said. "Kilzer, shut up and go check your notes or something. Look, GI, Major, we can get them out after we finish the shots and open up the pass. As long as we can get a chain around anything, the Shiva will yank them out like a cork." I knew it was a bad idea coming along this trip. Pruitt picked up a large rock and banged on the only bit of metal visible on the turret, which was the edge of the hatch. "Anybody in there?" he called. The response was muffled, but somehow the profanity filtered through. Actually, from the sounds of it, it was surprising it didn't scorch through. "Okay," he yelled. "We'll have you out in a second." The crew of the first Abrams to be yanked out of the rubble was scattered across the scarred surface of their tank, breathing real air and swearing like, well, soldiers that had been buried alive then unceremoniously yanked out of the ground. The vehicle itself was fully functional. It took more than a multi-ton avalanche of granite to break an Abrams, but the company commander and the major were having a hard-as-hell time convincing them that they had to get back in and drive. Pruitt checked the fit of the massive chain on the gun mantlet and then walked up the slope about 100 meters. There was always the possibility that the chain could slip, and he wanted to be far enough away that any possible reaction to that mishap would pass him by. He wasn't particularly worried about the chain breaking. It was the same design used to anchor aircraft carriers and had been adapted for Shiva recoveries. An Abrams tank, even covered in rubble, was not even in the same country, much less league. "Okay, Reeves, do it!" He looked up at the Shiva as it began to inch up the slope. He could tell that the driver had applied less than 10% power. Despite that, and despite going up a 30-degree slope, the chain snapped taut for just a moment, and then the 72-ton tank came out of the ground like a racehorse out of the gate. "Whoa there, big fella," he called as the weight of the chain dragged the Abrams further up the slope and then stopped. "And the next time you need roadside assistance..." Mitchell walked over to where the battalion commander was checking on the crew of the second tank. They hadn't taken any damage in the avalanche, but the TC had managed to break his nose when the vehicle was ripped out of the ground like a weed. The colonel waited to the side until LeBlanc was done talking to the crew, then walked further away as she strode over. The ground was rough, littered with rocks from boulders the size of small cars down to pebbles and dust, so he had to watch his step, in more ways than one. "Well, we have a road," he said, gesturing at the pass. What had previously been a slight saddle with sharp cliffs on each side was now a deep and nearly flat U-shape. "You have your tanks back, and everybody's happy." "They could have been killed," she muttered, but he could tell her heart wasn't in it. She turned to look up at the Shiva and shook her head. "That thing's just... amazing?" "Dangerous," she answered, but after a second she grinned. "And amazing." "Yeah, it is that," Mitchell said. "But when you've got a 7,000-ton vehicle on one side and a 70-ton vehicle on the other, being able to tow it, or hell, pull it out of set concrete, isn't that surprising. The bad part is, we haven't met up with what that amazing design is made to fight. And if you think this has been bad, wait until we meet up with our first lander." Getting the support forces across the gap turned out to be much harder than getting the mech over the ridge. At the end, the Abrams and the Shiva had been forced to tow the trucks over much of the rubble. But they had finally made it down to the Cowie Valley, and the whole assemblage stopped just short of the intersection of Cowie and Collar Creeks to work out their movement plan. "We've got to get down the Tennessee Valley and link up with the division, probably near Watauga Creek." Colonel Mitchell shone a flashlight on the maps and then looked up at the surrounding hills. Most of the armored force was up on them, looking around for Pauseline, with a few of the vehicles refueling at a time. None of the tracks were particularly low on fuel, but this might be the last chance to stop for gas, and the tankers hated running on anything other than a full tank. So far, the enemy had been staying out of sight, which was fine by him. "Not a long drive, but a pretty hard one. It's going to be a tight fit going through Iotla, and there's probably going to be Pauseline in front of us and behind. I don't know why there aren't any in this area. There were when we came through the first time, but they were behind us then. I'd frankly expected this valley to be crawling with the little bastards." "I'll put a couple of recon squads of Brad's out front," LeBlanc said. "Maybe 3,000-4,000 meters out. In this country, any further would be pointless, and that way, if they run into trouble, we can snug up fast." "Works for me," Mitchell said. "But we need to keep some support on the trucks." "Up a Charlie company in ASN Charlie position," the mech force commander said, taking off her crewman's helmet and scratching her hair. "I say Bravo on point, then Alpha, then you, then the support vehicles, and Charlie in trail. I'll ride with Alpha." "Concur," the colonel replied, flicking off the light. "I figure I don't have to remind you to keep an eye out in every direction?" "Nope," LeBlanc said with a tight smile. "But you can be sure I'll pass the word along." LeBlanc scanned the commander's viewer around and shook her head. She had paused the company along the forward slope of the ridges south of Cowie Church as Bravo bounded forward. So far, the enemy had yet to make an appearance, which just made no sense whatsoever. There were high ridges to both sides, and the Tennessee River snuggled the ridges to the west. It flowed northward from the wide valley near Franklin, then passed through a narrow gap which opened up into the valley they were currently in. The terrain was extremely broken, with a mixture of farms and woodland. The area was actually well-suited to defense against either humans or Pauseline. The problem being that they were in a movement to contact, and if they made contact, they would have to assault through. The terrain was not well suited to assault. She swung the viewer to the southwest at the lower hills across the river. Pauseline, by and large, were not very good at reading maps, but they had a certain logic to their movement. They wanted big targets, towns, factories, and cities, so they tended to stick to large roads, making the generally valid assumption that they would lead to the best targets. But they occasionally branched off on small roads, and there was a network of those across the river. She took another look at the map and shrugged, keying her microphone. Juliet 6-1, this is Alpha 6-1, over. Time to send some screening forces across the river. Juliet 6-1, over. Well, at least Lieutenant Wolf, the new Bravo company commander, was awake. He'd been the Bravo executive officer until Savannah, when the former commander had turned up among the missing. She found out after the battle that the XO had ended up leading the charge and immediately put him in command. Find a ford and send a platoon to make sure we don't have any visitors across the river. Over. Roger, out. She waited a moment until she saw a force of three Bradleys and an Abrams nosing down towards the river, then looked to the south again. Charlie 6-1, what's your position? Over. Getting ready to just stop west of Buzzard Ridge. Recon elements are just short of Iotla. Be aware that we're basically in road march formation. There's no room to spread out, and there's no way to cross the river around here. I can see that, LeBlanc called. Push it a little closer to Iotla. We can redeploy to the east if we have to. Roger, I'll push the scouts up to the edge of the Franklin Valley as well. Can they see the Iotla Bridge? Over. Stand by. She waited in the cold, wondering where the platoon from Bravo had gotten to and wondering when the movement to contact would become contact. Negative, Alpha. Sending them forward to the bridge at this time. Roger, move up and spread out. Get ready for Juliet to pass through your position. Roger, out. She switched over to intercom and ordered the tank to move forward. It was only as it rocked back into motion that she wondered if she should contact Mitchell. She's good, Mitchell muttered. What's that, sir? Pruitt asked. The two of them were nearly alone in the compartment. Reeves's position was forward and level down, so unless they used the intercom, it was impossible for him to hear their conversation. An Indian Kilzer were somewhere in the bowels of the Shiva. So Pruitt was the only one to hear the comment. He waited, wondering if the colonel would reply, and flipped from monitor to 7 to 8. He'd seen the platoon of tracks cross the river, then disappear behind a range of hills, wondering if maybe that was enough to send. She's got good control of her units, and she's got pretty good subordinates, Mitchell replied after a moment. She's also not letting things get ahead of her. She's using her forces effectively, and she's keeping control without micromanaging her subunits. I'd probably push the scouts out further than she has, but that's more by-the-book reaction on my part, and it would mean overruling the company commander. Frankly, if I had a battalion of tanks, I'd love to have her as a company commander. But she's a battalion commander, sir, Pruitt pointed out. Truth to tell, there's nothing wrong with her that a tour at command in General Staff College wouldn't sort out, the commander said by way of reply. Except that she could never have gotten to that point other than by how she has, sir, Pruitt said with a shrug. What happens if her tank has to crack track, or if the loader gets taken out? She can't slam shell. She can't crack track. She's too small and too light. She can get through some of it by sheer mental discipline, but the reality is she can't fight tank anywhere but in the TC hatch. I don't know, Mitchell said with a shrug. She can do that just fine, and, by and large, company and battalion commanders don't pull maintenance on their tracks. Besides, you can't crack a Shiva track. Nobody can, sir, the gunner pointed out. But virtually any guy could crack Abrams' track, and they have to in combat. I mean, could she even lift a tow cable? Probably, but I take your point, Mitchell said with a shrug. Fortunately, she did end up in command, though. Instead of some guy with big muscles and no brains. Yeah, Pruitt admitted, swiveling the monitor around to watch the track starting to move down the road. They were spread out as much as possible, but as he watched, first one platoon, then the other, dropped back into column march formation. As long as she can screen us to Franklin, I don't care if she pees standing up, sitting down, or standing on her head, Mitchell said. Well, I hope like hell it isn't the latter, sir. 'Tisn't a pretty image. Corporal Jerry Bazett flopped to the ground and shimmied forward under the low screen of bushes, thinking to himself that it was a damn cold night to be lying on the ground. He surveyed the terrain below the hill with his monocular, then switched to the thermal imaging scope on his AIW. With the monocular, even with the moon descending in the west, not much had been visible, just broken country and darkness. But as soon as he switched to thermal, he started picking out targets. The valley below was packed with Pozzoline, most of them stationary, as if awaiting a call, and all of them were looking to the east. Mitchell looked at the updated information and keyed the radio. Alpha 6-1, this is November 7-0. Plan? November, this is Alpha. How does game called? On account of lack of motivation sound. We have an estimated 30,000 in the flats and more on the hills. I was prepared to punch through light resistance, but this doesn't meet my definition of light. We can try to sneak up Sanders Town Road, Mitchell said doubtfully. Somehow the words sneak and Shiva just don't work in my head. Even over the frequency clipping radio, the note of humor was clear. The alternative is back up and shoot them with an area effect round, Mitchell said. Or can we get artillery fire from the 147th yet? Negative. They're still bottled up near the pass. Artillery is firing from Savannah, which is way too far. These guys are all oriented to the east, Mitchell said doubtfully. According to my scouts, LeBlanc answered, the description is that they look like they're waiting for something. Time, Mitchell said, thinking of the ACS unit trapped in the pass. Agreed, LeBlanc replied with a sigh. This is going to be ugly. LeBlanc looked at the map again and frowned. November, can you cross the river? Roger, over. She frowned again and looked at the update from the Bravo's platoon. The far side of the river was still clear, and they had halted in place when the Posleen large force had been spotted. I think I know how to handle this. We're going to be a major target, Kilzer said as the Shiva rumbled forward, and a big one at that. You said we were practically invulnerable from the front, Pruitt said, and it's been working out that way. Practically is not the same as entirely, Kilzer replied, and we're not invulnerable at all from the sides. There's a lot of damage that hasn't been repaired already. We'll be fine, Pruitt said, slewing the view sideways to where Bravo had gathered just below the hilltop that was holding the bridgehead. So far, the Posleen seemed entirely unaware of the presence of the armored force on their flank.